Hi, Jonathan. I'm super happy to see you again. It's really great. So I wanted to ask about, in the conversation with John Vervaeke, sort of towards the end, kind of talking about how all of the, you know, pattern, for lack of a better word, becomes, you know, embodied, you seemed like you sort of condescended towards the word cult. I don't know if you, you know, would be willing to stand behind that particular choice that you made, because I have some questions about that.
No, but I think I was trying to be provocative, but I mean, the word cult just means worship. That's what it means, and so, you know, that's what I meant in that sense. It, especially, like, I'm used to it because in French also the word cult, we'll use that word to talk about, even at a Protestant church, it would say the cult, because it was, that's the time you worship. That's just what I meant.
So you perhaps I'm confused, which is very likely actually, but do you think Jonathan, or John, would say that he would disagree about worship being the way in which the non-thing is embodied, let's say?
I mean, I don't know. John is right there.
I thought he would accept worship as like you know, but maybe not.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, if we were gonna take cult, you know, to be, I mean, there is something about, I think, you know, the word cult, you know, it does capture like almost a, it's like an unnatural attachment, you know, I think there's something about that which is part of the way that, you know, the Logos gets grounded or the incarnation happens or something, because, you know, Christ says a lot of very strange things, you know, in terms of, you know, you have to leave, you have to hate everything, and you have to, you know, even eat his body and blood. You know, that to me seems like almost such a close relationship that it puts me in mind of the type of almost unnaturally close relationships that the leaders of the cults have, let's say, with the people, you know, in them. So,
okay. So we can look at the story of Jesus if you want to get a sense of the difference between, let's say, what Christ does and a cult leader. That's an interesting idea, because one of the things that happens with Jesus is that he constantly is breaking the expectations of something like a cult leader. That's actually one of the things he seems to be doing. For example, you know, he does miracles. He tells people, don't tell anybody. You know, don't tell anybody about the miracle. He's constantly kind of shortcutting what you would expect of him. He is also, you know, the idea that there are images of him where he washes his disciples' feet, where he does the type of gesture that is very much the opposite of the cult leader. He tells them that they're going to die, that he's going to die, and then most of them are going to die, that they're going to go through the same thing that he did. And so there isn't a lot of, anyways, I when I look at the story, I see that he seems to undo the kind of charismatic cult leader thing constantly as he's acting. Does that kind of answer your question? But then in some ways, if you read St. Paul, you know, you get the sense that in some ways that's part of why he is recognized as the Messiah, is that he seems to be going against, he doesn't attract attention to himself, he doesn't try to get worship on himself, and then he just says that it goes up to the Father, and he gets brought down, and because he's brought down, then he's lifted up to the highest.
So, what? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. So you would say maybe All right.
Let me say one last thing. There's also something that happens in Christianity that is an extension of what happened with Christ, is that our saints usually have to die first before we see them as saints. And that's in some ways to avoid the cult problem, you know, the cult leader problem, is that you don't get veneration, you don't get celebration until you're dead. So you can't reap the benefits that you would think that a cult leader would reap in getting attention on themselves.
All right, thank you very much.
James?
John, thank you very much. I really appreciate this. This is my little corner. You know, I got my pastor here, my professor, and now my guru.
Oh, boy. After what I just said.
Yeah. You know, I've been fascinated with what you've said for a long time, and I really appreciate it. I really resonate with a lot of it. My journey is kind of a journey from a secular world of individualism now to a kind of a real desire to be more liturgical, more sacramental, more, you know, kind of this embodied participation in my faith. But in the background of that, from where I come from, there's a little bit of a kind of a worry, and your conversation yesterday kind of brings that up. I heard in that kind of attractive version of, let's say, celebration that you talked about, and maybe that's connected to worship and then this embodied participation. But part of that, and I think you even used these words yesterday, were that you kind of give yourself over to that larger thing as you are participating. You sacrifice to some degree your individuality to the whole. You are kind of submitting and giving up a little bit of your agency. And in that, there's always a gnawing worry for me about discernment and how we're able to continue in that kind of mode and yet still hold a bit of discernment about that. And, you know, I don't want to get too something too hyperbolic or emotionally fraught, but I think our generation, Paul has talked about Hitler as kind of the new Satan, the new example of evil outside the Christian frame. But for me, that history is more worrisome in the crowd that is following Hitler. And if you watch those films, it's just horrifying, the unanimity of that embodied participation. And so that's kind of in a background of concern for me, and I just was wanting to open it up for you to talk about that.
So the thing, this is, I mean, this in some ways, it's the joke, is that we need points of unity. We just do. We can't do without them, whether it's any team, any family, any group. We need something that is lifted up above and that we focus our common attention on and that can join us together into that common attention. Without that, the world doesn't exist. So the problem then comes is, how do we do that without the problem that you're bringing out? Because this is, in some ways you could say, that's how identity works. Identity excludes necessarily, and identity can exclude radically, and that's inevitable almost in the process, you know, by which it sets itself up. And so the question is, how do we avoid the difficult aspect of that? And I think the only solution we have is levels and a fractal joining, which is that the king is crowned by the bishop, right? And the bishop has no authority, no power, and is crowned by receives his position from tradition. And so there's a way in which it's set up so that things get handed up. And if they're handed up, then they're okay. So if your leader takes all the power or the authority for themselves, then you know that they're a problem. But if authority is distributed, both up and down, then you know that it should be okay. As soon as any level tries to compete with the levels below it, then you know that you're in trouble, right? When, let's say, the state tries to tell people how to raise their kids, for example, then you have to start to feel nervous, because in theory, these levels, they just, how can I say this? They fit into each other, and the top levels of authority don't compete with the lower levels. So there are ways to know whether or not something is wrong. The example of Hitler is a great example, because the normal way that it works is that, let's say, the king, or, you know, it's like you don't see the king. You don't know the king. The king doesn't talk to you, or maybe once a year he talks to you. And most of the time he talks to his aristocrats or whatever, and then those aristocrats talk to their people, and then those people talk to their people, and then it kind of flows down, and everybody needs everybody along the line. But Hitler could stand in front of 10,000 people with a microphone, and he could be like one many, and he was just flat with the one thing on top. That's dangerous, right? And so there are a few ways that we can see it, but the normal distribution of authority is something that people can pay attention to. Yeah.
Thank you, John.
Grim?
As he's coming, though, maybe I can say, if you look at, in Exodus, how God sets up the hierarchy, you can see that that's what God does. You know, and that if you notice any organization that doesn't have subsidiarity in it, it's dangerous, right? As soon as there's one leader and everybody follows, it's dangerous. But if the leader says, "Oh, Peter, you are my stone. I'm going to build my church on you," and then he gives authority to different disciples for different things that are important, then you feel like, okay, so this person trusts others along the line. But if the leader doesn't trust anyone, yeah, you're in a dictatorship. Hey!
Hello!
Finally meeting you in person.
Is this working? Okay, hello.
And you got Alan Moore to flash at me.
Yes, I have a gift for you from your nemesis.
You got Prometheus. That's awesome.
It's his masterwork about the apocalypse.
Thank you, thanks.
If you'd like to.
Oh, that's an amazing gift, man.
If you'd like to tear it apart symbolically, that'd be great.
That's an amazing gift.
I
have once in a while gone on Amazon to see if there's like a little collection I can get, and then find a way that I could buy it, but then not have my kids have access to it. If I get it, where do I put it so my kids don't read it? Sorry.
So I don't know if you're familiar with like your friends putting you into sticky situations.
Okay.
But I had a really great question for John, and Paul knew I wanted to talk to you, so... This happened. Some people have gone online and accused me of stylizing myself as a holy fool. Mm-hmm. What should I make of that? Where do I go from there? And do you have any recommendations for monetizing from that position?
All right, so someone asked, I've had this question before, and someone asked me, how do you recognize the difference between just a fool and a holy fool, right? Because that's true, because sometimes they're just fools. So the question, are you just a fool?
Jury's out.
No, so actually the way that you, I think, one of the ways that you recognize the fool, the holy fool, or the fool that plays the role, that's coming close to that role, is that the holy fool always makes sure that the last joke is on him, right? Always makes sure that the joke, or the turn, the wheel of kind of making fun of everything at the end kind of falls back on them, and they kind of take that. So they'll make fun of the king, but then they want to make sure that at the end of the performance, everybody's laughing at the fool. And so I think that that's a little image, because sometimes there are, I'm not saying this is your case, but I have encountered people that are just mean, and that they think they're being holy fools by just being mean, and they think they can just point out what's wrong with everything, and they think that that's something that has value in itself. Not necessarily. The holy fool has a different aspect, you know, and it's also the holy fool plays a role in secretly legitimizing the thing he's participating in, you know, and that's part of what the holy fool does, right? So the jester is both mocking the king and legitimizing the king at the same time, right? He's helping the king to avoid the problem of tyranny with the king thinking that he's God and has no faults, and so he'll make sure we all know that the king's got everything under that robe that we do, right? It's like he's as messy as all of us, right? So he's gonna try to do that, but he's ultimately doing to serve the kingdom, right, and not to destroy it. So maybe that's it. But I don't know, for the monetization part, I don't know. But
yeah, the king usually pays him, right?
That's right. That's a problem. So you gotta... It's good to meet you, man. Good to meet you.
Rajdeep? Grim has a Substack.
So how are you going to outdo that now? How are you going to outdo Grimm? I don't know. Is it possible?
Oh, Grimm makes sure every joke is he is the last joke. So he's very sincere in his efforts. So my question for you, Jonathan, is what is the relationship between violence and meaning? And then I'll give you some context of where I'm thinking about this stuff. It seems that violence is where objectivity enters the social realm. And in Sikhi, the tradition that I participate in, Sikhism, one of the names for God is Karta Purakh, which means creator person. But creator has this notion of a cut in it. And there's also a narrative idea that God creates with a sword. And there's, in the Guru, the Satguru, in the Guru calling God a Katar, there's an explicit rejection of the Indic concept of ahimsa, or non-harm. And I think that it's this non-harm which is integral in making the world unreal and mayic and illusory in things like Buddhism and the various Hinduisms. The idea that violence is something that makes the world real. And if you deny violence, you deny the reality. And as we worship at the god of safetyism, we make the moral more unreal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I know that.
No, but this is a very difficult question, because there's definitely a relationship between the sacred and violence. There's no doubt about that. I think René Girard points that out very successfully. I think he might mistake to what extent that is the case. Like, he seems to think that in some ways Christ has exposed the mechanisms of violence, and that in some ways maybe those mechanisms aren't necessary. And I think that it's a deeper question. You know, we have this image, we say, the lamb that was sacrificed before the foundation of the world. And the idea in several traditional cultures of the piercing, right? The piercing of the cosmic egg, that something has to break in order for the world to be possible. In some way, God has to break, something has to break. This is a very, very mysterious thing to talk about. It's very difficult because it can lead people on wrong paths. And we hear that with a lot of the fashion for kind of left-hand symbolism and the neo-tantrism. And all of this non-dual, this temptation to those types of non-dualisms, They're not completely stupid. I think they misunderstand a very basic aspect, but I think that they're not completely, because if it's true that God is all and that we have a form of non-dualism, then how to account for that necessity of cutting, right? The necessity of piercing, the necessity of breaking for something to exist. And at least in Christianity, the way that it's solved is the crucifixion, right? That's the way that the question is solved, which is ultimately the way that you deal with that is by turning the violence towards yourself. Not in a masochistic way, not in a suicidal way, but that you take the violence, you could say, on yourself. And that by doing that, you can become that lamb that creates the world. And so the martyr becomes the seed for the church. And the martyrs actually transformed the geography of Europe. Because as they die in places, people take their body and then build churches over them. And those churches become the centers for new towns that are now reoriented from the god of Mars or the god of this or these different gods. They're reoriented towards self-sacrifice as their root.
So even though participating in this pattern and letting the violence fall on you, there's still a recognition that it is, in some sense, the violence which is creating the distinction, which is creating, because in cutting, you're making things.
Yeah. There's a
you're giving identity through cutting.
So the world is made through cutting and joining.
Right.
That is inevitable. That's how reality works. And the image of the Son of Man with the sword coming, two-edged sword coming out of his mouth, that's this terrifying image of the way in which the Logos judges and cuts and includes and excludes. And we, you know, even as an Orthodox person, we don't tend to emphasize that symbolism so much. You know, we don't have a lot of fire and brimstone Orthodox teachers, but we can't also completely ignore that symbolism. It's there, right? The reaping, this idea that when Christ talks about reaping and separating, you know, that is an image of creation, you know, in making the world, that kind of has to happen. But let me give you one last little thing that I think is very powerful. This is an image that Timothy Petitza suggested, and I had the same intuition as him, but I never dared say it. And now that he said it, I feel like I can say it. He has a very deep intuition that when Adam and Eve took the apple, took the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, you know, there was the idea that if you take that fruit, then you have access to the tree of life. It was the tree that barred the way to the tree of life. So if you take the fruit, then you have access to the highest mystery. And his insight is that when Adam took the fruit, he did have access to the tree of life. And what he saw was the crucifixion. And that's why he freaked out. Couldn't deal with it. Okay, so that's the highest mystery? What am I looking at? I mean, obviously, it's very kind of mythological image, but it can help you understand like the place in the sacred and how there is an aspect of it which is terrible, right? Which is a terrible part of it. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Derek.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, do you have any dating advice for young men?
Oh man, I feel so sorry for everybody that's younger than me. I don't understand how it works with you guys, with the apps and the online. I'm so happy that I met my wife just before that became real. do I have advice? I would say in some ways, more than ever, we have to exercise discernment. I think that's very, very important, you know, on both sides, because some of the very basic tropes of what makes relationships successful, some very basic tropes of what we think We think that a relationship between a man and a woman are so broken that we have to exercise a lot of discernment. And so, I would say move slowly, choose wisely, you know. So I'm sorry, it's a tough time. I don't know what to say.
Here's something you can help me with what I'm trying to discern. On the topic of romance, do you think that romance is a real thing? Is it a drawing in with eros, or is it, you know, idolatry, as some people would say? What is your opinion on romance?
You know, I think the fact that seduction and sexual union is one of the prime images of unity with God is something that we can't completely avoid. Now, when you see some of the church fathers or some of the holy people that, you know, I love, obviously, they always want to point to it's the relationship. You know, it's like, oh, Song of Solomon, that's the soul in God. Like, don't get too caught up in the details of what's going on. But yeah, that's true that's what it ultimately is, but it's really using a type of symbolism. You know, when I say symbolism happens, it means that it has to kind of go both ways. It can't just be that one points to the other, because that pointing to the other is what makes it real. And so I think that in a romantic encounter and in the proper alignment of seduction and even of the rapture, right, it's meant to be a little glimpse of what unity with being united with God is. And the reason why it's so dangerous is in maybe because it's one of the closest things to that. So because of it, it's so easy to mistake for the real thing. It's so easy to think that this is the one. And so that's why there's been so much effort in every culture, in every society, to find a way to box that sex thing somehow. We got to find a way to contain it, because it's so powerful. And so that's why in Christianity there's an ascetic aspect to sexuality and to seduction and to courtship and to love. And that ascetic aspect of just marrying one person, for example, just having one person and building your life with them, that I think it's the best way to put that on the right track, right? So that the very relationship, the very sexual union you have with your spouse is ultimately going to lead ascetically, necessarily, just by the fact that you get older, by the fact all the realities of being human will ascetically lead towards not worshiping sexuality. It kind of has to happen. You have to give up some of that drive, especially as a man, as you enter into a monogamous relationship. It's just slowly happening, kind of preparing you for a higher participation in God.
Oh, I really like the framework that you put on that. I think because I come from a Protestant denomination, maybe I've seen it talked about differently. They would say, first, you need to conquer your lusts. And, you know, a young man goes into the pastor's office, like, what can I do to find an eternal wife? And he says, give away all your desires and give away all your lusts. And the man does that. But when he comes back and he's like, he doesn't ask, like, oh, where can I find a woman? He's like, oh, I'm done. You know, I'm ascetic, or, you know, I don't feel the drive again for that lust, for that eros and that desire for romance. They just want to continue on with their books or some other, I don't want to say distraction, because that sounds mean, but some other care, whether that be, you know, Christ, or whether that be church or something else.
The thing about entering into a relationship with someone and finding the right person, it's like everything. And it's what I'm going to tell you is going to annoy the hell out of you. And that if you want it too much, you run more of a risk of not getting it. You know, and that's a very practical advice, because girls don't like desperate guys. It's just how it is. And so if you're so hungry and like, just, I need to find a wife, like, you'll just have women running away from you at like 100 miles an hour, right? And so in some ways what you said about giving up your lust, I agree. I understand how that can be trite or ridiculous, but there's a way in which that's some way it's true. You have to master it to some extent, and you have to be able to rise above it to some extent, or else you'll just scare people off. And so I would say it's all in proportion is the best way to understand that. So good luck.
Thank you.